Greetings, friends. I'm John Haspel. This is a recording of our Tuesday evening Dhamma class from Cross River Meditation Center on December 3rd, 2019. This is class 27 of 32 classes of our structured study of Vipassana, introspective insight into Anicca, Anatta, and Dukkha. My Dhamma talk and our Sangha discussion is on the Salatha and the Bahiya Suttas. If you find benefit from this talk, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. Thank you. Peace.
Be at peace with your mind. What a nice charge from the Buddha from 2,600 years ago. Why not? Why not be at peace? So tonight is class 27, I believe. So we're in the last quarter of this structured study of introspective insight into the three marks of existence. Up until the Jhana Sutta and concluding in that sutta, if you haven't listened to that talk from, I think it was a week ago, please do so. It's an important one. And that sutta kind of brought all the classes together in the focus that they were meant, that a well-concentrated mind is able to observe itself. And so the rest of the study is, in general, going to be what a skillful and authentic Dhamma practice looks like and what the individual actually does in this practice, what it looks like, and how it develops. So these two suttas tonight, did everybody notice that there's two suttas in the email?
No?
Did you?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Did anybody besides Laura? I'm not going to put you down. I'm just trying to find out if I need to be more clear in my email. I'm sorry, Laura.
Lauren
is the only one that didn't know.
I thought it was just the one.
Okay. I need to be more clear. So.
The only thing I thought of is that the Bahiya Sutra could have followed right after.
It is.
It is in the front page, but after you read through the 2 hours, I thought maybe it could have been right at the bottom.
It is. Oh, on the
right
link.
After
the okay.
Yeah, because when I printed them out, I...
That's why there's two links there.
Yeah.
Okay. I will be more clear. It's very rare that I'll teach two suttas on the same night, unless we're on retreat, then I might teach 10, but... The reason why is that these two suttas are so complementary. The Salatha Sutta teaches how an individual creates stress and suffering for themselves and what to do about it. The Bahiya Sutta describes the accomplishment of doing just that and what that looks like. And so they really could be one sutta, even though they're not, because the Salatha Sutta in general provides... teaches the problem and shows the resolution, and the Bahiya Sutta gives a very clear example of what that looks like and what that feels like. So let me continue. And these are two of the most significant secondary, is that the word we decided to use, Ram? Secondary suttas, meaning there are primary suttas such as dependent origination, the Paticca-samuppada Sutta, and the suttas on Four Noble Truths, the Eightfold Path, Satipatthana, Anapanamana, Sati Sutta. And then there's some suttas that support the understanding in those other suttas. And these two are one of the most significant ones that do that. So,
would you consider the Nagara Sutta as the primary or secondary?
I never thought about that. It's a sutta that needs understanding, and I'm surprised that I never came across the Nagara Sutta in all my years in modern Buddhism until I actually read it myself. Mm. So I think it's key to to answer your question, yes, it's a primary sutta because it teaches what the Buddha actually struggled with and awakened to. And that informs all of our Dhamma practice. So this sutta is known as the Sutta of the 2 Hours, the Salatha Sutta. In this sutta, a question is put to the Buddha as to what is the distinguishing factor between a well-instructed and well-informed Dhamma practitioner and those that have no understanding of the Four Noble Truths. In other words, what does this look like? The Buddha responds, "Friends, listen and pay close attention. An ordinary uninformed person feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings, meaning ambiguous. One well-informed of the Four Noble Truths also feels feelings of pleasure, feelings of pain, and neutral feelings. When, through the sixth sense base, an uninformed person experiences a feeling of pain, they are sorrowful, they grieve, they become distraught and irate. Why do we become distraught and irate when we're feeling pain?
Yeah, wow.
That's why. And think about it. If you weren't taking it personally, you wouldn't have any of those feelings, correct? So you might have something that we identify as pain, but you won't lose your mind over it. And that's really the best way to describe it. Even if it's a mild upset over your pain, you're still losing your mind. It's the reaction that is the second arrow. Continue. The uninformed feels two pains, the physical pain of the experience and the mental pain caused by the reaction arising from clinging to views ignorant of Four Noble Truths, such as this shouldn't be happening or it shouldn't be happening to me. Does everybody recognize the foolishness in that one self-referential statement?
Yeah.
Why? Putting you on it. This is quiz night. Why?
Because it's not personal.
Yeah. Because there's nothing personal about it.
You're not going to make it any different.
Yes.
There is dukkha.
And yes. And so what's the Buddha's description of dukkha?
Five clinging aggregates.
And birth, sickness, aging, and death. It's simply as a... as a consequence of having a human life, every human being will have pain. Of course, it's individual and it varies greatly. And some people have much more pain than other people. And some people seem to skate through life without too much pain, but they do. They will feel feelings of pain at times. And there'll be disappointment, another aspect of dukkha. But all of that ends when we develop understanding of Four Noble Truths and stop taking everything or anything personally. And you'll see how that theme is reflected so clearly by the Buddha's words to Bahia in the next sutta. I better watch my commentary, I'll never get to it. The Buddha said, this would be like being hit with an arrow and then by request, being hit again by another arrow. And that's the description of when I react and take things personally, I'm sticking the second arrow in. As opposed to just understanding that this pain or this disappointment or this great benefit is simply a consequence of having a human life. There's nothing personal about it. As the person is experiencing pain, pain resistance occurs, leading to resistance obsession. That's the Buddha's description of how conditioned thinking arises, develops within us. We feel a feeling of pain, and now we are averse to further pain, aren't we? And so when similar situations or similar people that cause pain in the past come into our life or arise in our life, we react to it. And sometimes it's so irrational that even before an experience that would have caused pain or upset occurs, we're already upset about it. We're worrying or we're projecting something into a situation or with another encounter with another human being because of conditioning. And then that brings us to what's occurring in this moment. If my mind is so conditioned, no matter what occurs in this moment, I am going to see it from that corrupted conditioned view. And the Buddha just described how it occurs. We create an obsession, a resistance obsession to our life as our life unfolds. Does everybody see that clearly?
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a resistance to this, to a ambiguous pain, because all pain is actually ambiguous, even though we're experiencing it. Once it's gone, it's gone. And then the thought of it is a fabrication. It's only in this moment that pain is affecting us. And so in this moment, if I can not take things personal, no matter what's occurring, and I'm talking about any kind of pain, not just physical pain. If in this moment I'm not taking it personally, the second arrow is not struck. Nothing is arising. I'm simply experiencing life as life occurs, an awakened human being.
That second line of this paragraph is unclear to me. First line is, as a person experiences pain, pain's resistance occurs, leading to resistance obsession. As the person experiences pain, delight in sensual pleasure occurs.
Yes. And we do delight in our sensual pleasures, don't we?
And even come from pain.
Because it's a distraction. A good example would be somebody banging their head against the wall.
Mm-hmm.
The pain brings them back into their body. And there's a delight for that. A delight in that sense doesn't mean, oh, this is so wonderful. Mm-hmm. It means that I'm drawn to it. I'm clinging to it. I'm attached to it.
Oh.
And the Buddha often described in general dukkha, that the problem with dukkha is that we join with our suffering. We identify with it. I have a headache. I had an awful day. I had an argument with my best friend. I. It's all I making. Instead of, there was an argument, not taking it personal. It's just a consequence of having a human life. An awakened human being still might get into an argument, but you won't take it personal. You might make a point, is what I'm saying. You might continue to live within the Four Noble Truths, but you won't take it personal. And if you're not able to convince another person that your position is the right position, which you wouldn't be doing, you don't take that personal. Everything occurs to a common peaceful mind, and there's nothing left within that individual to change that way. And you'll see how that applies in the Bahiya Sutta. As the person experiences pain, delight, or obsession in sensual pleasure occurs. Any distraction, that's why I often say that the Buddha could have nearly as accurately described the First Noble Truth as saying there is distraction as saying there is dukkha, because it's the preoccupation with stress and suffering and disappointment that takes us out of our body and takes us out of our life in the moment. That the Buddha is describing that. Obsession is another word for distraction here. Reaction brings obsession as the uninformed does not understand what is actually present. The origination, this is what is actually present. We don't understand the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling. Remember the three suttas on dukkha? The Dukkha Sutta, the Maha Dukkha Khanda Sutta, and the Kula Dukkha Khanda Sutta. All three of those suttas, the Buddha described the allure, the drawback, and the release of sensuality. And then he would conclude those three descriptions as saying, in short, there is sensuality. There's craving after sensual pleasure, whatever that might be. As the uninformed does not understand the origination, the allure, the drawback, and the passing away of the feeling, then any ignorance obsession with regard to this feeling of pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain, meaning ambiguity, overcomes and obsesses them. Any ignorance obsession. And the ultimate obsession is to maintain or ignore my own ignorance of Four Noble Truths. And in order to do so, in order to maintain that ignorance, I have to live a fabricated life reacting to my own fabricated views. That sounds a little complicated or discursive, but it's not. In fact, if you look at that closely, that's a linear progression from ignorance to stress and suffering. You can relate that directly to the dependent origination and how the Buddha teaches in there from this initial ignorance through those 12 observable causative links that are also described here. How an individual grasps onto something that is fabricated, insists that it's me or it's happening to me, and creates stress and suffering out of nothing, literally nothing. Even if it's something that's actually occurring in reality. Because when I'm evaluating something from a fabricated view, I don't know what I'm looking at. Is that clear?
Yeah.
Even though what I'm looking at is exactly the same thing as that I understand it to be when I awaken. Mm-hmm. That sounds crazy, doesn't it? But it's like trying to look out a window that the shades are drawn, and because I know that there's a world out there, I says, wow, it's a beautiful day out there, even though it's 9 o'clock at night. Because that's what I want to believe. That's how I want my whole life to be. But it can't be, can it? Because the Buddha tells me that in life, there's going to be stress and suffering. And I don't have to take any of it personal. The Buddha continues, sensing pleasure or pain, or neither pleasure nor pain, the uninformed, through self-reference or personalizing the experience, joins with it. The uninformed is joined to birth, aging, sickness, death, and joined with sorrows, grief, and pain, and despair. Through reaction to the experience, the uninformed joins with and furthers their confusion and suffering. The well-informed person, meaning a practitioner of the Dhamma, when stress arises, has no resistance. With no resistance obsession can occur. No resistance distraction can occur. That's a description of a common peaceful mind, isn't it? The well-informed, when stress arises, has no resistance. With no resistance obsession is formed. mind is calm and at peace. They feel one pain, physical but not mental. Just as if they were shot with an arrow but not another, they would feel only one pain, the physical pain. With no delight, meaning reaction, in sensual pleasure, no pleasure obsession occurs. The well-informed person understands what is actually present and understands its origination, its allure, its drawbacks, and its passing away. They do not become sorrowful, regretful, or distraught. They remain disjoined from pleasure and pain. How do we get to that point of being disjoined from pleasure and pain?
Practice.
The Eightfold Path.
That's almost an addiction, more than a pretty way to say condition.
Yes.
It's really an addiction because if you're in your practice and you keep going back to wrong view, it really is a mental addiction.
Absolutely. And so, and you could apply other words to that, like compulsion. But it is, they're all aspects of addiction. We're addicted to our own fabricated false views of ourselves. And so just like an addiction, as we start the beginning process of not feeding the addiction, there is a withdrawal. And sometimes it feels like a struggle. Sometimes it feels like a fabricated type of bliss, like you're just out of your mind with happiness. It's too exaggerated. Or it might be a deep fear, but it's all fabricated. And we cling to it or we're addicted to it because of what it gives us. I learned a long time ago that one of the best ways, Matt, you might want to talk about this after I say it. When you're present with someone, and I'm talking about diagnosing someone's difficulties and not coming from the point of view of a doctor, just being present with someone, the first thing you might learn, and Matt is outstanding in this, is to just look at how the person's living their life, because it's in living our life that we create all the difficulties in ourselves. So once we look at a person's life, and maybe we should apply it to myself, but I'll keep it on that objectified view. And then we look at what is this situation giving that person? And oftentimes you can see the root cause of the issue when you see what clinging to the pain is giving that person, because they created an identity. You could probably explain that idea better than me.
Well, I think it was well said.
Thank you. You know,
it's to me, it's always in how. It's not why, it's how. How you're doing what you're doing. So you could be eating the right things and doing the right things and going to class and doing all the things that you're supposed to be doing, but the underlying issue is how you're doing those things. If I'm going to an exercise class or a yoga class or a meditation class or a Qigong class or whatever, and I get there and I'm going like this, how am I going to experience the benefit of what I'm supposed to be doing? So I could go a million years and not get it. So it's always in your life. It's always in your life. It's always in how you're doing what you're doing. And this is where right view comes in. So this is coming right back to the Eightfold Path.
Yeah.
If I can enter and remain in right view, how I'm doing what I'm doing changes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then, like you'd said earlier, you know, when we're able to see ourselves in action, when we're able to see our minds convulsing or whatever, then we can start to go, oh, there it is. I did it again. There's my habit. Otherwise, it's completely automatic, completely unconscious.
Yep.
Wouldn't that be where discernment of what you're doing comes into play?
Yes, in that, but it takes concentration to see yourself in action. It takes that development of concentration to do that. But yes. Yeah.
And the, obviously concentration comes from
John,
obviously. And the discernment is the truth in any particular situation, occurrence that we encounter.
Okay, well, wait, that's such a good point. What's the truth in the moment?
The truth in the moment is the Eightfold Path. It's whatever the situation is. It could be.
Wait, I'm going to cut you. I don't mean to be rude. I'm not trying to be, but it's such an important point. The truth, as the Buddha teaches, is there is stress, there's the origination of stress, there's the cessation of stress, and there's the Eightfold Path leading to that cessation of stress. That's the truth. That's the Buddha's Dhamma. When the Buddha's referring here that the well-informed understands this, that's what the well-informed understands. In this moment, something stressful is arising. I don't react to it. Why? Because I see it. Wow, this is stress. I know where it comes from. I know it's cessation, and I have developed the Eightfold Path leading to that cessation. Of course, that's not, most human beings won't have that thought. It's just a natural way of living in the world. The truth of stress. Do you see the full circle of this?
Mm-hmm.
Even relating to dependent origination from ignorance through 12 observable causative links comes stress and suffering. It still relates back to understanding stress. So what's the origination of stress?
Ignorance.
I mean, how simple could it be? Really? It's our own complicated and confused minds that make it seem very, very difficult to understand, but it's that difficulty, it comes from what we're talking about here too. The conditioning aspect of being joined, not being joined, joining with my suffering. I'm conditioning myself to ignore the fact that I'm doing it myself. I'm convincing myself to ignore I'm the shooter of the second arrow. That's the whole point of this sutta. Let me continue. Thank you, Matt. Thank you, Michael. The well-instructed person, understanding stress, does not generate a mental reaction to pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain. That last one too, when life is calm and at peace, a self-referential ego personality would likely identify that period in their life as incredibly boring. A wise, well-instructed Dhamma practitioner simply enjoys the peace of nothing, nothing going on. This is something that is kind of contrary to the way we're even taught, that we shouldn't have too much quiet time. We should always be doing things. We should always be achieving something. And that's gotten to the point of obsession where it's normal for people to work 60-hour weeks and think that that's just what they have to do, which is, it's so. And sometimes you're in a situation where you absolutely have to work that many hours, and there's a certain feeling of being fortunate that you're doing it, but to do it as something that you're driven to do from an ego standpoint is simply stress compounding stress, isn't it? We don't always have to be doing something. In fact, when you have the ability to sit and do nothing and feel pretty good about it, you've come a long way, because most people can't do that. The Buddha continues. This is the distinction between those uninformed and those well-informed of the Four Noble Truths. What's the distinction? A wise person does not generate a mental reaction to pain, pleasure, or neither pleasure nor pain. This is the distinction between those uninformed and those well-informed. Another way of saying a mind that's resting in peace is a mind that's not reacting. A well-instructed person who has developed the heartwood of the Dhamma, meaning the Eightfold Path, understands the arising and the passing away of all phenomena, meaning the three marks of existence. Craving and aversion no longer distract the mind or continue ignorance. Approval and rejection are dismissed, no longer in existence. Approval and rejection are dismissed, no longer in existence. Imagine living your life for just a couple of days without having to approve of anything. Well, we can do it for the rest of our lives. There's no reason to approve anything, because that is always self-referential, isn't it? I approve of this, or I disapprove of this.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than simply being present, I'm not talking about a further distracted by developing a trance-like way of living in the world, or something that is completely, what's the right word? Removed from the world in a forceful way. That's not establishing seclusion in the world, is it? Or disentanglement. But a wise Dhamma practitioner who has developed a Dhamma, what the Buddha is pointing out here, is that no matter what is occurring, their mind is at peace. Now, no dust remains, or sorrow or regret either. For those that understand the Dhamma, they have left behind becoming further ignorant and have arrived at the far shore of awakening. Skip over that. I thought that was the end of the sutta, just to give the sutta the bow it deserves. And I'm going to go right into the Bahiya Sutta because you'll see the connection. Bahiya was revered in his community as a person of great understanding. One day in seclusion, Bahiya entertained the idea of whether he was an arahant, an enlightened being, or was he lacking in some key understanding. And let me say this first. In meditation, a female diva told him that he was not yet an arahant. In fact, his current practice did not have the qualities that could give rise to enlightenment. I'm referencing the female diva because that's what's in the sutta, but we understand that these references to disincarnate beings are similar to the references to Mara throughout the Pali, the Sutta Pitaka. Mara and these mentions of divas are simply a way of drawing a picture of a quality of mind. So this is something that occurs within Bahiya. And it was common during the Buddha's time, and it's still somewhat common today, especially in certain forms of modern Buddhism, to attribute mental states to disincarnate beings. In fact, probably a good example of that would be the god Avalokiteshvara, like I say. And that's usually depicted as this being with eight arms and limbs and all this stuff. And you know, it's a common Buddhist picture. Avalokiteshvara is simply the mental depiction of a compassionate quality of mind. But there's people that worship the fabricated abstract view rather than actually develop that within themselves. There's no substitution. In fact, his current practice did not have the qualities that could give rise to enlightenment. He asked the diva, or insight arose within him, if there was one in the world who knew the way to enlightenment. The diva told Bahiya of the arahant, a rightly self-awakened one, who teaches his Dhamma. The Buddha was in Savatthi at the time. Bahiya immediately left to find the Buddha and learn the Dhamma. He came upon a group of monks and asked if they knew where to find the Buddha. The monks told Bahiya that the Buddha was on his alms round. Bahiya, everybody knows what alms is?
Mm-hmm.
Going out for your daily food. Bahiya went into town and came upon the Buddha. Bahiya feared impermanence and uncertainty and was concerned that he or the Buddha may die before he, Bahiya, received the Dhamma. The Buddha was serene and at peace. Bahiya placed himself at the Buddha's feet and asked, "Teach me the Dhamma, awakened one. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." The Buddha replied, "This is not the time, Bahiya. I am on my alms round." Bahiya pleaded, "Awakened one, no one can know for sure the dangers there may be for you or for me. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." A second time, the Buddha responded, "This is not the time, Bahiya. I am on my alms round." Again, Bahiya pleaded, "Awaken one. No one can know for sure the dangers there may be for you or for me. Teach me the Dhamma for my long-term welfare and lasting happiness." Finally, the Buddha relented. "I will teach you the Dhamma, Bahiya. Listen carefully to my words." So listen carefully to the Buddha's words. And relate this right back to what we just, the past sutta, the Salata Sutta. "Train yourself in this manner. In what is seen, there is only the seen. In what is heard, there is only the heard. In what is sensed, there is only the sensed. In what is cognized, only the cognized. This is how you should train yourself. When for you, there is in what is seen, only the seen. In what is heard, only the heard. In what is sensed, only the sensed. And in what is cognized, only the cognized. Then Bahiya, there is no you in connection to what is seen, heard, sensed, or cognized." How does that relate, or does it? I mean, it relates directly back to the Salata Sutta, doesn't it? He's teaching Bahia to stop putting the second arrow in himself. When there's no you here, there, or anywhere. When there is no you there, you are neither here nor there nor anywhere in between. It's kind of a simple statement, but it really encompasses the entire Dhamma and the Buddha's teaching on establishing yourself in non-physical speculative realms, because that's what he's referring to. Neither here nor there or anywhere else in between, meaning any place that you can imagine, stop creating false selves. This is one of the most powerful statements on abandoning any speculative type of Dharma practice and trying to establish yourself outside of where you are in this present moment. When for you, there is no you here, there, or anywhere in between. And when you start integrating this, you start realizing the necessity of constant eye making in each moment. Every here, there, and anywhere in between, we must continue to maintain a fabricated self in order to maintain ignorance. And as soon as that starts falling away, then we start developing the Dhamma. This and only this is the end of stress and unhappiness. This and only this. The end of eye making, the end of taking things personal. Upon hearing the words of the Buddha, Bahia's mind cleared, meaning he awakened. Clinging and grasping, greed and aversion ended, and all self-referential views were extinguished. Bahia awakened, gaining full human maturity. Shortly after Bahia's encounter with the Buddha and his enlightenment, he was attacked and killed by a cow.
That's
why I don't like this. No, I don't. Some people, I mean, the irony is laughable too. It's sad, but also Bahia got it. The most significant thing that he could have accomplished in his lifetime, he did. He didn't get a chance to enjoy it much, but the Buddha, upon hearing of Bahia's death, instructed some monks to retrieve the body, to cremate it properly, and to prepare a memorial to Bahia. When completed, the monks, knowing Bahia's awakening, asked the Buddha what Bahia's future state would be. In other words, these weren't well-informed monks. They still were wondering what happens to Bahia now that he's dead. The Buddha's brilliant reply. Monks, Bahia was wise. He practiced the Dhamma in accordance with the Dhamma, and you've heard me say I love this line, and he did not pester me with issues not related to the Dhamma. Bahia, monks, is totally unbound. Totally unbound from what? What's he declaring there?
Self.
Wrong views himself.
Yeah.
Yep, very good. The Buddha continues, where water, earth, fire, and wind have no footing, the four elements. Remember the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, where the Buddha describes every human being is made up of these six properties, the four elements, the space property, and the consciousness property. And here he says, where those elements, earth, fire, wind, and water, have no footing, there the stars don't shine, the sun is invisible. That could be a little confusing. Does anybody know what the Buddha is referring to there? There's no created world, meaning self-created world. We're not living in the cosmos. We're living within ourselves. We're not living any type of fabricated view. There, the moon doesn't appear. There, darkness is not found. And when a sage, a Brahmin, through great wisdom and discernment, has realized this for himself, then from form and formless, meaning from a physical form to a speculative non-physical form, from form and formless, from birth, from bliss and pain, he is freed. Thank you. So those last references to the sun and the moon, etc., we're not creating worlds for ourselves. In other words, we're not clinging to these things. Of course, an awakened human being still sees the sun and still sees the moon, but there's nothing personal about it. It's not my moon. It's not my sun. It's not the sun isn't rising and going down for me. It's simply a consequence of living in the world, period. All of it. There's no phenomena that we take personal once we understand it. Why? Because there's no me here, there, or anywhere in between. So, who should we start? Start down that end. Hi, Kevin.
Hello. Nice to be here. Nice to see all of you. How are you doing, John?
I'm doing good. Thanks for asking.
Appreciate these two talks. They're very timely. I think that they summarize the study pretty well and sort of points back to, again, everything resolves within the self. And it's takes practice and concentration, and if you stick with it, you'll be able to see when you tend to stick those second arrows in. So better get to it to figure it out.
Yeah.
I need that work too. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. The cow's chasing all of us. Hello, man.
John. Good to see you. Good to see everybody. I missed all of you.
Mm-hmm. We missed you too.
Thank you for your teaching.
Thank you for being here. Hello, Lorna.
Hello. I think this is probably one of my favorite lines of paragraphs. What, only what is seen is seen, only what is heard. It just describes how we should be.
Yeah.
And also, I can relate to being here, you know, being here, being there, being everywhere, whereas I'm not. I'm only in this body. I'm not, I can't project myself into anywhere else, but I can imagine in my own imagination, I think that way.
Yeah.
So it, I think it's probably one of my favorite passages. And what I hadn't thought about, I don't think, before, was at the end where he says that where there is no sun arising, there is no moon arising. I think he's referring to when you're dead, you're dead. You know, there's no... everything ends. You know?
Yeah.
It ends.
Yeah, just ends.
And I think that kind of like then loops back onto Bahir and his urgency to understand the Dharma and get to receive the teaching from the Buddha so he could understand the Dharma, because he understood when it ends, it's gone. When it's gone, it's gone.
Yeah.
So get to it. Get to the practice. Get to the teaching. Get to the Buddha, if you possibly could. Or, you know, that's what the sutta's really about. It's it's urgent.
Yeah. And it... Yeah, I'm sorry, did I interrupt you?
No, done.
And it is just that urgent too. You know, this is, nobody knows when the cow's going to get us. Nobody knows what the next moment's going to bring. And even beyond that, you know, not trying to introduce fear as a motivating factor, but understanding that Bahir was lucky, even though the cow got him, at least he awakened in a human lifetime. I think I was saying it to Laura. I mean, to me, the most important thing in life is just this, is the Dhamma, an awakening. Why, what else is more important? It's not to say that because other things are less important, we shouldn't even be, but this is the significant thing for a human life, is to understand what it means to have a human life and not take any of it personally. Get on with it. Hey, Andrew.
Thank you, John. I have nothing.
I'm glad you're here. Hello, Rob.
Hi, John. As I said before, the reading the Salada Sutta and finding stuff in there that I truly did not remember that was there before. and it's a really good section of like how this process worked from experiencing stress or suffering and going into delight, reaction, and I don't recall ever seeing that in any other sutta before, how he just picks that apart.
Yeah.
Said, this leads to that, to that.
Yeah. Mm. And it's so clear. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Thank you. I mean, we are, we're doing just this. We're doing just what the Buddha's teaching Bahir to do and everybody else. We're developing the same Dhamma, and it's resolving the same way. We're resolving wrong views of self. That's what we're doing. That's what every class is about, isn't it? In some way. And understanding what are true views of self, what actually constitutes a self, a human being. And this is it. This is what constitutes a human being the defining characteristic of a human being is a calm and peaceful mind. And what could be more valuable to a human being than a calm and peaceful mind? It's what I was always looking for. I didn't realize it for a long time that that's what I was chasing after. I used to think I could find it in the bottom of a bottle of vodka or a bag of cocaine or marijuana and other things that addiction leads to, or compulsive thinking or compulsive behavior. It was all trying to resolve that issue of stress and suffering in a very misguided way, but we do it in all kinds of strange ways, don't we? And hurtful ways to ourselves and others. And then there's this peaceful way out. Now this is the irony in my life, looking out on the world like the Buddha did in the Bhava Sutta, Loka Sutta, the world is a flame. The irony of human beings not doing this the absurdity in that is so obvious to me now. But of course, I understand that it's so that the Dhamma isn't available for everyone. It just isn't. It's not meant to be, or not intended to be. It's intended for those with just a little speck of dust in their eyes. And here we are, and it's working. We're having this effect. There's less of us here, there, and everywhere else than there used to be, isn't there? And as a consequence of that, we are all developing a more calm and peaceful mind. Hello, Kate.
Hi, how are you?
I'm good. Thanks for asking. How are you?
Good. I just liked the two arrows metaphor in the first sutta. I wish they all had kind of like a nice, clean way of, you know.
Me too.
Pointing stuff out all the time. Just that you can't choose the first arrow, but you do choose the second.
Yes.
It's something that I still struggle with, but keeping it in mind, recognizing it, so.
Yeah, and struggling with it is okay because you're learning it. Is the idea of the second arrow something that you, I don't know quite how to ask the question. I'm asking because of your position that you've been practicing about 6 months or so. Before that, if you heard this sutta, would it made much sense to you or be useful?
No, I mean, before I didn't see a difference between pain that is part of a normal human life and the suffering that you add to it. I thought it was all the same.
Yeah, that's outstanding. That is what the sutta is.
Yeah, I would have never seen the difference before. Yeah. So.
And that is a significant difference. I mean, that's, again, that's the essence of the Dhamma, to look at what we're doing to ourselves and to others. So, thank you, Kate. Good evening, Tim.
Good evening. I'm just very appreciative and full of gratitude to the Sangha, to Buddhist teachings, and to this Dhamma, to the Dhammas. And that's all I have to add.
Thank you, Tim. Me too. Hello, Mary.
Hello, John. Hello, everyone. I heard things in this that, I probably needed to hear or don't, you know, the last time I heard it, I needed to hear something different. So yeah. I heard what I heard. And with the rigor of a practice, you can get yourself to a place where you hear what needs to be heard. Mm. Anyway, thank you.
Thank you. Hello, David.
Thank you.
Hi, Helen.
Hello, John. Hello, everyone. Good to be here. I missed last week. I think I was asleep by 7 o'clock. I agree with what Lorna was saying.
Excuse me.
What I was thinking, although I took the lack of sun, moon, and stars to be the 6 foot under part of it, but same idea. And just listening to the sutta again, as Mary said, you hear things sometimes in just a very discreetly different way or more clear way. And the second arrow is the one that you, impale yourself with.
Yeah.
But it's not just if you do it once, it's like if it becomes a habit or a conditioned behavior, it really is an obsession, a compulsion, an addiction. And I remember one time my minister and his wife were taking a walk in the park, and that someone from their parish or their neighborhood caught up with them and started telling them about all the sickness and suffering and pain and all of this, and then, nice to see you guys, and walked off and like dumped everything on them. But what he was thinking, the minister was thinking about, was if someone sees their pain in that way and in such great detail, and they that need to talk about it, there's something that they're getting from it, and it's that validating self, you know, that I am suffering, I am this, and it's you know, like when old people get together and talk about their operations, need that mind moment. But when you hear that kind of suffering dump happening, I guess part of that intention is for them to really hand it to you, but it's sort of because of our knowledge of what it actually is, we don't do that. We don't carry that load. And if there's a way that we can help that person to let it go too, that's a level of understanding that you can then communicate to someone else. And, you know, that takes a lot. Understanding things on your own personal level is one achievement, but being able to really effectively communicate it is a much higher level.
Yeah. Thank you. And it takes a certain wisdom to know how to do that. In other words, depending on the position you're in, you can cause a lot of harm by validating people's stress and suffering, mm-hmm. and actually exaggerating it within their own mind.
Or even, in a sense, invalidating it. You know, if you just went right away and say, yeah, I see you've got a compound fracture in your leg today, but it's not always going to be there. Get over it. You know, that's not going to work either.
What it really takes is that a fully mature, awakened human being who can stay mindfully present and not feed into the self-identification with distress and suffering, and simply be present for the understanding that this is part of having a human life. That's all. And there's nothing that happens to an individual that's never happened to another individual in this world. That's just the way it is. And so we learn through the Dhamma to just stay mindfully present with people. At some point, Bonnie may want to talk to this a little bit. At some point, it's not helpful to let people going on and on about how awful things are for them. It just isn't. I mean, it's a hurtful thing to do. And then if you have an understanding of the Dhamma, and the person is receptive, you can start. It's a good time to introduce the Dhamma. Or you might have a situation where all you can do is just. You're never going to hear this. I had a cousin of mine called me yesterday. He's a little older than I am. He was working with his son for many, many, many years, probably 30 or 40 years, and he got fired. And he called me, and he had a lot of choice things to say about his son, my cousin, and my second cousin. And I listened for a little while, and I said, Gary, I know it's really awful, but you know, at 70, he's 70 years old. I said, at 70, you understand that everything changes, you know? I'm not trying to give him a Dhamma teaching, that this will pass too. And it calmed him down enough to stop calling his son this and that, and understanding that, okay, maybe tomorrow I can get my job back, instead of being caught up in the hate that he was. It literally was hate. And he calmed down a little bit. I didn't give him a Dhamma teaching, did I? But I didn't let him go on and on and on about how awful his son is in the situation he's in. Anyway, thank you, Helen. Hello, Bonnie.
Hello, John. I just think that the practice, or when we're mindful and when I'm engaging in self-reflection, then I have choice. And so then I can choose how I want to respond so that I... Yeah, it's a choice, I think. But we have to be able to see that.
Yes, and you're giving yourself an opportunity to introduce the Eightfold Path into what you're, refine mindfulness into what's occurring, rather than just reacting.
It's like a Mobius strip.
Yeah, it is. Thank you. Karen, how are you tonight?
Hello. Very well, thank you.
Good.
In my early journey with this, I've been practicing what these were discussing, and I was able to practice it more when half the time I have my daughter with me, and half the time I don't. She's with my with her father, and when it was just me, I had that time, that quiet time, to think about these things as they came up and practice them. And then when my daughter was back with me, things got busy, and I'm looking forward to taking what was discussed tonight, and working on that when I have my daughter with her.
Thank you. Wow, thank you, Karen. There's a lot of right view in what you just said, you know, and be gentle when you start doing that. But this is, you're actually right. The Dhamma is best applied in the real world. You know, we need the seclusion and the quiet of just that. But if we're going to be living in the world, again, if we're not taking vows and living in a monastery, this is where we practice the Dhamma, isn't it? When kids are over, or other things are occurring, or bosses are mad at us, or people are making claims on television, or, you know, whatever it is, it's just part of having a human life. None of it's personal. And not that I know, because I can't, but it's probably pretty difficult to depersonalize motherhood, isn't it?
That's what I was contemplating during these discussions, yeah.
Yeah, so I was being a little silly, and just from this, not the standpoint of experience, from the standpoint of the Dhamma, even there, it's best to not take it personal. But of course, you're always there for... Pardon me?
Easier said. Yo,
I'm sure it is. I mean, that's what I mean. It's much easier to depersonalize a broken lawnmower than a hurt child, isn't it?
Right.
But it is really important that you do that.
It is. Yeah. For the child too. And I, you know, again,
I'm very much looking forward to it. I think not jumping right in and talking right away and taking a breath, using right. a breath in those moments.
Yeah. Yeah. How old is your daughter, if I can ask?
15.
So she's about that point where you can really start introducing some more direct concepts, how you act in the world and how it makes you feel. Maybe she's not ready. Thank you, Karen.
Thank you.
Hey, Brett.
Hey, I'm good to be here. Thank you for the teaching. And it's helpful for what everybody was saying tonight. It was a lot out of that.
Yeah.
It was a good teaching for me because just going through a lot of conflict with a client, and so I've been taking a lot of it personally, and so it was good to have a reminder that I don't have to take this personally, and to practice a little bit harder. So
yeah,
good to be here.
I'm glad you're here. As a business owner, it is difficult to not personalize customers like that. But it's the key to having a peaceful business, too. Hello, Michael.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
Great teaching, as usual. Always lots of stuff there to comprehend. But one thing I learned from this whole thing, okay, and I didn't realize it myself, maybe a lot of other individuals did, didn't realize, cows are very aggressive animals.
They can be.
I never realized how aggressive they can be trampling people unless there's a herd of them. So that's my realization here tonight.
That's what it's true.
Keep a border collie with you.
Thank you.
Yeah. That's sheep.
Remember Pukasati, he got the cow too.
Hi, Josh.
Hello, Julia.
I enjoyed the 2 arrows and then the example of Bhagya very much. The thing, seeing the story of the 2 arrows, the metaphor, was not that I didn't realize, you know, the meaning of the story, but it was kind of interesting seeing it in words, you know, and you say, oh, that's it, that's exactly what it is.
Yeah.
You know, it's the first hour is painful, but the second hour is the worst, because that's our own undoing that causes a great stress in our lives. My experience in life, I guess, is I've always been a person that I never tried to like react. I try to think things through and be logical always. And so a lot of times if I had an interaction with somebody, I wouldn't spit out something. I would write it down. I have my journals filled with stuff. But anyway, I would write down my feelings. And a lot of times, a couple of days later, I'd say, these are my feelings. And I'm like, that's too personal. You know, I made it too personal. I made it an experience of something that was, you know, over personalizing something that it wasn't worth it. And I would be, you know, I'd crumble it up and say, I'm not going to say that anymore. And so that's the way I dealt with it back then. Now I find myself, I don't have to write it down anymore. I pretty much, when I'm interacting, I realize almost automatically, just as in the story, I realize the second hour before it's about, and I capture it before it's about to hit me. You know, I don't make it be a personal thing anymore.
Yeah.
You know? So I enjoyed the stories. It was very good.
Thank you. That again, a great example of not taking things personally. It seems like such a simple thing, but it's a key to happiness. Jane, I bet you thought I forgot about you.
Oh, I thought maybe.
Never. How are you tonight?
I'm fine. How are you?
I'm good.
Now, I picked up on the one thing you said was that we don't always have to feel like we need to be doing something.
Yeah.
That prior to my Dhamma practice, there were times when I sat and did nothing, but there was always that guilt that I should be doing something. And now with my Dhamma practice, I can, when I find peace, especially after I meditate, it's okay to sit in peaceful abiding. You know, no guilt, just peace.
Yeah. It is. We think that we shouldn't be doing that, taking care of ourselves in that way, but why not? Thank you. Thank you, Jane. Wow, what a great class. I mentioned earlier about having this experience of actually developing the Dhamma. It's quite subtle and quite profound, isn't it? And I think as you start, and I'm saying this because you're all kind of there. Allowing the Dhamma to be the Dhamma is also an expression of not putting me in the Dhamma. There's no me here, there, or anywhere within the Dhamma either. Does everybody get that? I said it because I think you do get it. And that's such a subtle, but like a pro, you keep using the same word, profound thing to understand. But it's there within the Dhamma to understand that. And it's remarkable that as a Sangha, and I will include you, Karen, because based on what you've said, you understand this. This is, when we get to the last sutta on the Anapanasati Sutta in this series, I'll talk more about it. But this is, the Buddha talked about a Sangha just like this Sangha. 2,600 years ago, his Sangha. And he said that a Sangha like this is rare in the world. Think about that. Even during the Buddha's time, he acknowledged that actual Dhamma practitioners who had a living Buddha to teach them was rare in the world. You got me, and you're still doing it. Good work. We'll finish with the Karaniya Metta Sutta, as we always do. What's that?
We'll finish there.
So again, take a moment.
We're very blessed to have you.
No, Well, boy, talk about a symbiotic relationship, isn't it? All of us, not just me and you. It's this Sangha. It's just remarkable. It really is. Thank you. Don't forget our dinner next week.
So stay away from cows, John.
Well, with me, it might be a muskrat or a hamster that gets me. So I'm watching out for everything. Trampled
by a turtle.
It was a turtle that got him. Can you believe it? This is what should be done. This is what should be done by one who is skilled in goodness and who knows the path of peace. Let them be able and upright, straightforward and gentle in speech, humble and not conceited, contented and easily satisfied, unburdened with duties and frugal in their ways, peaceful and calm and wise and skillful, not proud or demanding in nature. Let them not do the slightest thing that the wise would later reprove. Wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Whatever living beings there may be, whether they are weak or strong, omitting none, the great or the mighty, medium, short, or small, the seen and the unseen, those living near and far away, those born and to be born, may all beings be at ease. Let none deceive another or despise any being in any state. Let none through anger or ill will wish harm upon another. Even as a mother protects with her life her child, her only child, so with a boundless heart should one cherish all living beings. Radiating kindness over the entire world, spreading upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, freed from hatred and ill will. Whether standing or walking, seated or lying down, free from drowsiness, one should sustain this recollection. This is said to be the sublime abiding. By not holding to fixed views, the pure-hearted one, having clarity of vision, being freed from all sense desires, is not born again into this world. Thank you all for a wonderful class tonight.
Thank
peace.
You,
thank you, Jane.
Thanks, John. Have a good week.
You too.
Thank you for listening. I rely on donations to support these talks. If you find benefit from these talks, please consider a donation at becoming-buddha.com. I welcome your questions and comments. To contact me and for guided meditations and instructions, Dhamma articles, recorded talks, and videos, please visit becoming-buddha.com. These talks are copyrighted and are distributed under a Creative Commons License 4.0. Peace.